Jeff Blankford joins me again today. He is a fellow radio host and a writer for IRMEP, the Institute for Research Middle Eastern Policy. He's been an activist longer than I've been alive. And we're going to talk about the Israeli lobbies, problems with the Palestinian Solidarity Movement, the Zionist left, and a bit about the Kennedys.
Hello.
Oh, you hear me?
Yeah.
Good.
Let's see.
We sabotaged.
Could be the NSA. You never know.
NSA, ADL.
Well, when you say NSA, that's kind of Israel anyway, because we know they're sharing everything with them. And prior to that, it could be Converse or InfoSeek or Nexus or any of the
small NSAs. Right.
Yeah. I think they've been spying on me forever.
Well, they when the ADL when I got my ADL file, which is very lucky because it was just a matter of timing when I found out from my co-plaintiff, Steve Zeltzer, that he had gotten his ADL file from the district attorney. So I was in his file. So I called the DA, assistant DA, and I said, "Can I get my file?" He said, "Sure, come on over." So I didn't live that far from the Hall of Injustice or Justice. I went over there. I got my file, which had been heavily all my Middle East work was missing. Literally, none of my Middle East activities were in my ADL file. Other material that they got from FBI or somebody was in there. A lot of it was really erroneous, which was really I thought quite amazing. But that evening, a judge closed the files up, and they've never been open ever since. If Steve and I didn't get our files that day, there'd have been no case.
Wow. Well, you're one of the few, maybe the only one, to take on the ADL and win in the court of law.
No, there was a couple in, I think, in Denver, who complained about their neighbors. Their neighbors are accusing them of anti-Semitism. You know, and the ADL said, "Anti-Semitism, where? You know, if they didn't create the situation. So they attacked, I forget the exact details of the case, but the ADL lost that case. And they don't like to talk about it. And unfortunately, the ADL influence, that somehow the opposition groups, the Palestine Solidarity groups, never touch it.
Well, I saw the ADL's sort of hit list this year for the most anti-Semitic, and they had like Code Pink and all these anti-war groups on there. It was ridiculous. Have you seen the film Defamation?
Yes, yes.
That guy really shows how ridiculous the ADL is. It's a loser sitting in an office looking for anti-Semitism under every rock. If they can't find it, they'll invent it.
Well, I'm in their. Well, I used to be on their hard mailing list, and every time I'd open the envelope, there'd be pictures of skinheads, and Nazis, neo-Nazis. You see, and they're right around the corner, and the ADL's protecting us from them. And I'm on their email list, so I get their emails, and these are simply they're competing with other Jewish organizations for funds. So the anti-Semitism is to them what drug trafficking is to the DEA, or cancer is the American Cancer Society. If there was no problem, they'd have no reason to exist. Of course, the ADL's fighting against anti-Semitism is a very small part of their operations, and they've been spying on people going back to the 30s.
Well, also, what they really do is they consider any criticism of the nation of Israel to be anti-Semitism, even though it isn't.
No, well, actually, there's a proper way to criticize Israel, but by the time you do it the ADL way, nobody's around to listen to you anymore.
Well, they did a write-up about a film I made, and they put me – they said it was anti-Semitic and crazy and whatever, and just did this smear piece. And they packaged me in with someone else who probably really is an anti-Semite and lumped the two films together as if they were, you know, the same, and they're not at all. And I could probably sue them for that if I had any money.
Well, this was what they did with Mearsheimer and Walt. They threw him in with David Duke.
Right, who was a Klan person.
You see, right. And so even though Duke has a lot of things to say that are very positive and are backed up by fact, his reputation before he became involved in international politics precedes him and follows him wherever he goes. And so by simply mentioning the name David Duke, you're smeared. I mean, so Mearsheimer and Walt, who actually pulled their punches in order to get that book published.
I think I have to mention they wrote The Lobby about mostly AIPAC and all the different lobbies. I know you know what it is. I'm just saying for everybody.
Oh, yeah. They mention in their book that AIPAC has legitimate right to lobby, and they just do it better than anyone else. And that's almost what you have to say if you're going to get published by a mainstream publisher. And even that Farrar Straus took on that book and published it was quite extraordinary. But then again, you found it being attacked not only within the predictable right-wing media, but also in Democracy Now!, Amy Goodman, instead of doing the professional thing and inviting either Walt or Mearsheimer or both of them onto her program, she brings in Noam Chomsky, the gatekeeper, and who obviously had not read the book. And he kind of patronizes them and says, yes, nice try, guys, but that's really not the problem. And that was really a way she contributed and continues to contribute to blocking any real discussion of the role of the Israel lobby, which to me is more important for Americans than to discussing what exactly is going on in the occupied territories and in Israel, because in fact, most activists know what's going on there. Most Americans don't really care, given what's going on in the world. We see what just happened in the Philippines, a horrible situation. And that's a natural disaster. But what's going on in the Congo and other places, Americans by and large are isolated and don't really care to hear about suffering. They do, I believe, care about who is diddling their government or diddling them. And in this case, it's the Israel lobby, and they've been doing it for a long time and very expertly, so expertly that you can't talk about it.
I think they don't see the connection, though, because you have gatekeepers that say, like, for example, Noam Chomsky saying the war in Iraq was all about oil or this and that. And so they don't see that the reason we are trillions of dollars in debt and the reason we've had these wars of choice are because of Israeli influence and Israeli desired foreign policy. There's no reason to put a target on Iran. There's no reason for us to be in Syria. And there was no reason for us to invade Iraq. Those are all Israeli objectives. And the pretexts for those wars came from Israeli partisans in the DOD, and they're based on Israeli think tanks and Israeli policy papers. But Chomsky and the left like to get up and say it's about oil or whatever and make excuses.
Well, they don't. Right. And of course, it's easy to disprove the oil theory because Iraq, Saddam, like the Iranians, were willing to sell oil to U.S. or international major oil companies, but they were not allowed to do that by sanctions pushed by the Israel lobby. I remember Tom Lantos, who was instrumental in pushing the U.S. into going into Kuwait and taking out Iraq by bringing in the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador and pretending that she was a nurse, that it was in a hospital in Iraq, and the Iraqi army came in and threw all these babies in incubators out on the floor and took the incubators back to Iraq. Of course, it was a stone lie. A few people revealed in the mainstream
PR firm conducted lie, right, too. She didn't do it by herself.
And well, as a matter of fact, Lantos wrote something called the House Human Rights Caucus, but it sounded like an official caucus of Congress, but it wasn't. It was based in Hill and Knowlton. Lantos, ironically, was always supported in the San Francisco area. One, because he was very good on labor positions, and so the San Francisco Labor Council and the Peninsula Labor Council would always support him. Most people aren't aware of it. We hadn't mentioned it before, but the AFL-CIO has long been one of the cornerstones of the Israel lobby, not a supporter just of Israel, but a major player, unique in the world, in terms of dealing with support for Palestinian workers, international solidarity. It doesn't exist when it comes to Palestine.
Another myth about the second Iraq War too is this petrodollar thing. They say that Saddam was going to, you know, buy his oil in euros, and that happened in 2002. But the propaganda for the war in Iraq started in 1998, and they recycled those lies after September 11th. It was about the mobile weapons labs and the chemical weapons under his palace and all the WMDs. All that, they acted like it was new evidence, but it was actually old lies they'd already been saying for years, long before the euro existed or the EU existed or any of that. It had nothing to do with that. It was a war for Israeli interests, for sure. But they will go endlessly on about that stuff.
Well, actually, going back to 1991, when Bush, even though, as he called Saddam a Hitler, Bush did not want to depose Saddam, but he did not want to destabilize the region. And the neocons jumped on him. I went back into the newspaper files in the San Francisco Library to look at what editorial comments were in the New York Times and the Washington Post in 1991, and the U.S. News and World Report, edited by Mortimer Zuckerman, who is a major part of the Israel lobby. Actually, calling it a lobby, it implies that it has to beseech politicians to do what it wants to do. The Israel lobby tells politicians what it wants them to do. In any case, and there were all these columns from Sapphire in the New York Times, from Rosenbaum in the New York Times, goading Bush. Here's a veteran. Bush fought in the war as a wimp because he had all these soldiers in Saudi Arabia waiting to go into Kuwait, and he was delaying doing this, because Bush Sr. was seriously trying to get Saddam to leave. And that, from that time on, the neocons began to attack Bush because he didn't take out Saddam. And then we had the situation where Israel, in 1991, made a demand upon the U.S. They did provide Israel with $10 billion in loan guarantees. Well, at that time, the U.S. economy was in terrible shape. Unemployment was up. It was really dragging. And Bush was trying to get a peace agreement or peace conference to take place in Madrid, because he wanted to bring an end to the Israel-Arab conflict. Now, Noam Chomsky and other people on the left will tell you the U.S. wants to continue the Israel-Arab conflict, but they don't provide evidence for it. The evidence that the U.S. continues to send money and arms to Israel is not evidence. That's evidence of the power of the Jewish establishment and AIPAC in this country. It does not show that the U.S. wants Israel to continue occupying Palestinian territory, because they never give a good reason why the U.S. should want this.
Yeah,
in any case,
gain out of that?
They never say. I mean, Chomsky would like you to think that when Israel, I mean, the words he uses, when Israel attacks, let's say, Lebanon, this is not Israel attacking Lebanon. This is the U.S. attacking Lebanon with Israeli pilots flying American planes. Literally, that's what he said in a book called The New Intifada. In the same book, the late, great Edward Said takes a position on the Israel lobby, which is the absolute truth about the Zionist control of the media and the establishment and so on. No one quotes Edward Said on that, but it's in there. And although Said and Chomsky were good friends, I suspect Chomsky or Said never read Chomsky, because what did Chomsky have to tell him about Palestine that he didn't know? In any case, back to the loan guarantees, Bush realized that if he approved these loan guarantees, at the time he was hoping that Arab countries would come to Madrid and join in peace talks, that this would break the talks off. It would make them a failure. And of course, Itzhak Shamir, the Israeli prime minister, wanted to do that. In any case, when Bush realized that both houses of Congress had enough votes to override a veto, that he planned to veto the legislation, which he made public, he decided to do something that was without precedent, to go to the American people. And he went on television on the morning of September 12th, 1991, and he told the American public that he was trying to make peace in the Middle East, and that there were 1,000 lobbyists up on Capitol Hill, which there were that day. He didn't say Jewish, but it was implied, against little old me. And then he told the public how much money each Israeli man, woman, and child received each year from the American taxpayer. And he said, I'm going to do what I think is right for the American people. Well, this was a blow to the solar plexus of the Israel lobby. They were never expecting this. The polls showed anywhere from 75 to 85% of the American public supported Bush. And even like weeks later, only 44% of the American public supported aid to Israel, whereas 77, 75% supported aid to the former Soviet Union, Russia, and to Poland. These statistics, these facts have been deep-sixed, not just by the establishment, but by Chomsky and the so-called Solidarity Movement, which follows him like a shepherd leading a flock of lambs. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, I've written articles critical of Chomsky, but I've communicated with him, and I asked him if he had read a book called Broken Covenant, American Foreign Policy and the Crisis Between U.S. and Israel by Moshe Aarons, a former defense minister of Israel, who describes in detail the relations between Israel and the first Bush administration, which totally contradict Chomsky's statement that Bush was a big supporter of Israel.
They went after him for that as well.
But they went after him, and it was interesting. In the Washington Jewish Week, there was a really good reporter named Larry Kohler, and he covered the story of the loan guarantees. And he reports how Barbara Mikulski, a senator from Maryland, very pro-Israel, was meeting with a group of Jewish lobbyists and telling them how much she supported the loan guarantees, when someone handed her a note. Now, I'm quoting from memory, but by Larry Kohler, her face went ashen, the article said, and she said, I've just learned that the president has taken the issue of the loan guarantees to the American people. Imagine that, to the American people, the last group of that the Israel lobby wanted to be involved in something involving their money. This to me was such a revealing moment. And I used it in a couple of articles, but no one else has reprinted it, because what it shows is the power and the willingness of American politicians to sell their country to a foreign country, essentially Israel, which is a foreign country. And those people who say that we have shared values and all this kind of stuff, the only shared values is we're not responsible for our crimes and we could take whatever we want. Those are the only values that I know that Israel and the United States share. Maybe you know a couple of others. And if you criticize them, well, here you're un-American. Of course, if you criticize Israel, you're anti-Semitic. But in any case, there's a funny story.
Isn't that something? There's a country openly engaged in ethnic cleansing and house demolition. And if you call them out on their racism, you're racist.
That's
how it is.
And when members of Congress openly declare themselves supporting Israel against positions of U.S. president, as Steny Hoyer has done in Jerusalem against Obama, as there was a congressman, Richard Gebhardt, did against Bill Clinton, held a stage press conferences in Jerusalem to take the side of Netanyahu in both cases against the president of the United States. Clinton, even at that point, was trying to get Israel to release some more land to the Palestinians, because Israel keeps talking about giving up things, and they've given up nothing.
But it's a funny story. Land they stole to begin with, let's point out.
The land they stole to begin with.
Give back land we took from you. So they're not really losing any land.
We'll give you 22%, or maybe 10%, or maybe 15%, but we control the airspace, the borders,
the water.
Everything, the water particularly is important. But in this book, Broken Covenant, is a wonderful story in which Daniel Inouye, the former, the late senator from Hawaii,
the Iran-Contra,
who was and who covered up Israel and Iran-Contra by calling it Country A instead of calling it Israel, identifying it as Israel.
They did the same thing during the Plame affair. They just kept saying Foreign Country A, and we all know what it was.
We know, but you see, the public doesn't know, and unfortunately, they've been educated not to pry. But Inouye was in the office with Moshe Arens. Moshe Arens was in Washington, and Inouye was paying his respects, getting his orders, and so on. And I should say, Inouye's first job when he got out of the army in World War II was to sell Israel bonds. That was removed from his bio, but I found it there very early on. And he actually once was going to convert to Judaism. He's a Methodist to Judaism. But the lobby said, it's much better you stay a Methodist than convert to Judaism. Bush made the announcement he was going to go to the public, Inouye says to Moshe Arens, "Where's my yarmulke? We're going to war." This shows whose country he's loyal to. And it's interesting, when the first intifada broke out, Inouye was ready to provide Israel not only with new aid, but to forgive all the debts that Israel owed at that time. And along came Jonathan Pollard, got busted, and he had to drop that.
In part because of Weinberger.
Weinberger was an American hero. If it wasn't for Weinberger, Pollard would have probably walked or gotten a few years at the most. Another occasion, Inouye got in trouble, got chastised because he had appropriated $8 million for a Jewish school in Paris. It's the shameless pandering.
Was there even a Jewish school? Because I know Hillary Clinton, they embezzled some money like that. And the schools in New Square, New York, do you know about this? They didn't even exist, and they were collecting money for things that weren't even there.
Oh, if we talk about New York, New York is occupied territory. The religious Jews, having nothing to do with Israel, the Orthodox Jews in Israel, in New York, some of them have their own towns. It's like occupied territory. But they have scammed federal, state, and local monies to an extent that is extraordinary. They get money for computers in schools where there are no computers. I mean, computer connections where they have no computers. The Homeland Security provides money to certain nonprofit institutions that might be in danger. 97% of those are Jewish institutions. The scams that go on, and it's interesting, the New York Jewish Weekly, The Forward, reports on these scams. But the mainstream newspaper, The New York Times, does not see them fit to print, nor, of course, The Washington Post.
Because they get accused of anti-Semitism, and all these grown-ups are scared of being called a name. You know, that's all it takes to shut someone up.
Well, it's not just anti-Semitism. It's also advertising.
Oh, yes.
You can go and as a block And the Orthodox Jews or ultra-Orthodox Jews in New York are voting blocks. Their rabbi tells them who to vote for, and that's who they vote for. And that's not even debated. There's no democracy. I mean, these are cults.
It's always 98% all one way.
And
there's a leverage in advertising, too, because this is sort of a microcosm of AIPAC. What you have is a way where people can lobby government to get money, so they're getting subsidized, and then all they have to do, Congress is giving away other people's money, so they don't care. And then once they have that money, all they have to do is use a portion of that to continue to lobby to get more money, and you get great returns for that. So they're not even competing with normal advertisers. You don't have to sell anything or anything. Just use the government to get money, and then use some of that money to get more money from the government the following year.
And the thing is, people in the public, as I say, are afraid to say anything because they'll be accused of anti-Semitism. And this has worked. And also, another thing is it's too much trouble. You know, they have this group called CAMRA, the Committee for Accuracy in Middle East Reporting, that goes after any newspaper, any radio station, any program that it considers to be critical of Israel, or in other words, anti-Semitic. And there is a WBUR in Boston, the NPR affiliate, lost $1 million in underwriting when CAMRA accused it of being pro-Palestinian. Now, this, of course, is a joke. Anyone who listens to NPR knows it's not pro-Palestinian, anything but. You never hear a Palestinian voice, and you're constantly hearing Israelis being interviewed. But in this particular case, they must have done one program. And so what they do, CAMRA contacts the advertisers. And the advertisers, just like the newspapers, they do not want to take on a Leviathan like the Israel lobby. This is why even in the San Francisco Chronicle some years back, whose publisher and editor were both Jewish, not particularly pro-Israel, but you know, they're newspaper people. And when the first group of international solidarity people came back from the West Bank and were interviewed by a Chronicle reporter and photographer for 2 hours at a press conference, which is a pretty good time to spend with a story, at the very same time, a group in the Jewish Community Relations Council, accompanied by Walter Shorenstein, at that time was the most important political Jewish leader in California. He was on the board of AIPAC. He owned one-third of the financial district of San Francisco, and he was on the board of the California Democratic Council. Shorenstein and the board from the JCRC, Jewish Community Relations Council, went to the publisher and the managing editor and accused them of having a pro-Palestinian bias because they had covered a pro-Palestinian demonstration, not well, but had not covered a pro-Israel demonstration. Now, the pro-Israel demonstration was minute and not very important. But in any case, the Chronicle killed the story about the International Solidarity Movement. There was a time when it was very easy to get people on the air who were critical of Israel, Palestinians and Israelis, but now it's closed, totally closed. It's like every opening, the lobby goes around and closes it. 24/7, 365 a year, they are on the job, and you'd have to admire them in a certain sense for the ability to get done what they wanted to do. And now you see they have been so coddled, the Jewish establishment, so coddled by the media, by other religious groups in this country, that they do not know how they appear to other people, non-Jewish Americans, and even to Jews the majority of men who are not part of the establishment and don't follow what they're doing. But article yesterday, how the Jewish establishment, Jewish leaders are upset with Obama and Kerry because of the negotiations with Iran and because Kerry, in a press conference, said that if Israel and Palestine don't have an agreement, there might be a third intifada. So essentially, what these Jewish leaders are saying is you have to listen to us. And none of the mainstream media mentioned that a couple of weeks ago, the White House representatives, Obama's henchmen, met with four leaders of the American Jewish community from AIPAC, the ADL, from the Jewish community, Jewish Council of Public Affairs, which is the umbrella group for all the Jewish federations in the country, and from Malcolm Honlein, of the executive director of what's called the Council of Major Jewish American Organizations, an umbrella group, to tell them that he would not sell Israel out to Iran. Not a single mainstream American newspaper, TV, radio station carried this story, nor did Democracy Now. It was, however, in the Jewish and Israeli press. But it's interesting how, if Americans, the ordinary American, knew that every week or two, the White House is having a meeting to explain its policy to a group of American Jews, they would say, how do they rate? How do they rate? And then you have the ADL having these polls, constantly having polls, to see how anti-Semitic American Jews are. They say, Americans are. They say, classic question, do you think Jews have too much power in the United States? And if you say yes, of course, you're an anti-Semite. Anyone who doesn't think so, and we're saying Jews, we're talking about the Jewish establishment, about 30% of American Jews. The rest might as well be Mormons, Protestants, Catholics, Muslims. It wouldn't matter, but it's that core establishment that counts, and that's why all these articles you may read, oh, Jews turning away from Israel, they're meaningless. It's like disinformation. The establishment is as solid as it's ever been. And as a matter of fact, AIPAC is the Jewish group that continues to grow and get more money than all the other groups. Many Jewish groups don't get money from Jews anymore. Even the ADL has problems. But AIPAC, every conference that they have in Washington every year, is bigger than the one before. So when you have, last time, 13,000 people coming to a conference, I've been outside of it protesting. It's like a big Nuremberg rally for Israel. And usually half the members of Congress attend. Mm-hmm. Last year, 3/4 of the members of Congress attended. And what's very important is they have the reading of the members of Congress, the names of the members of Congress are read like an honor.
When a bill's being passed that most of them don't read, they barely have enough or a majority there at all to get it passed, but they'll go show up at AIPAC, but not Washington, where they're paid to actually supposedly represent us.
Well, when it comes to an AIPAC drafted bill, the Senate now votes 100-0.
Yeah,
and Congress votes. Since Robert Byrd, the last one, even good old Bernie Sanders is good on every other issue. When it comes to Israel, he's just like McCain and Lindsey Graham. This is a sad reality, but you won't hear that anywhere. People don't question that, and so-called left, let's say, and its main media organ, Democracy Now!, never mentioned any of these bills. For example, the Senate Resolution 65 back in May, in which the Senate voted a resolution that said, if I think of May or June, that if Israel attacks Iran on its own, that the U.S. will support Israel economically, politically, and militarily. Even though then it says at the bottom, this is not an authorization for war, but this is not believable. It was
backdoor way into war.
Right.
And actually, Lindsey Graham, a couple weeks ago, we gave him another $488 million. That went on quietly as well.
That's never mentioned.
That's as our parks and things were being shut down, and they're giving $500 million to Israel and cutting food stamps in the United States.
Cutting food stamps. The city of Detroit is going under. Let the people in Detroit know what Israel's getting, and not just that. They get millions of dollars in tax-exempt donations. There's an organization that most Americans, even most Jews, haven't heard of, called the Friends of the Israel Defense Forces. This is an American organization which raises millions of dollars every year, about $50, $60 million a year, from American Jews to send to provide R&R for lonely Israeli soldiers who might have, let's say, come to the United States and are serving in the Israeli military and might be lonely. So this is the kind of money that they get. And what's interesting is that even at all these events, they have major entertainment and major figures attending. Not a single word in the mainstream media that I have ever been able to find. And I have a Google alert. That's how I find out.
And well, for example, anchors like on CNN, Wolf Blitzer, who are former AIPAC employees. So there's no wonder they're not reporting on it. And he supposes
well, it's
one
not
of
just
more objective
AIPAC
ones.
Yeah. No, it's not even Wolf Blitzer. Just last month, they held the annual Friends of the Israeli Defense Force event in Beverly Hills. Chaim Saban, the one of the biggest Democratic Party donors and a man who has admitted to the New Yorker, a one-issue man, and that issue is Israel. In 2002, he gave $12.3 million to the Democratic Party, bought the Brookings Institution for $12.3 million, and got started the Saban Center, bought Univision, the Spanish language TV program, for $12.3 million. He likes 1, 2, 3, $12.3 million. He is the host in Beverly Hills every year of their annual event. And this year they set all-time record of $20 million. The previous record, I think it was 14. The previous year, which is a response to the fact that Stevie Wonder had pulled out. Now, Stevie Wonder is well known, yet his appearance and his pulling out was not considered to be news anywhere in the mainstream media, only in the Jewish media. And this time they had Lionel Richie and Simon Cowell, who is a judge or something for American Idol and some other program I don't watch. In any case, they raised $20 million. Of 2.3 of that came from Chaim Saban, tax deductible. One of the most interesting donors is a man named Yekiel Eckstein, a rabbi, which means nothing because rabbis can be just as big a criminal as your average pickpocket, except they do a better job of it. Eckstein donated $4.5 million on behalf of the International Conference of Christians and Jews. Now, this is about the same amount he donated last year to the event in New York, which is held every year at the Waldorf Astoria. Where does this money come from? Does it come from Christians who are giving money to an organization that $4.5 million, $9 million in 1 year donated to the Israeli Defense Forces? I think we should require some kind of investigation.
By the way, they bulldozed down a church in the occupied territories. So that's what they're paying for. Church property is getting destroyed.
And with someone being supervised by the so-called Israel Defense Forces. I remember it's a similar name, the South African Defense Forces. They were two strong allies back in the day. So you have organization like this giving millions of dollars. And there's Larry Ellison of Oracle. He donated $1 million. This should be news somewhere in a mainstream newspaper. But the power of the Israel lobby is that they could not only put articles in that they want, but they keep articles out that they don't want. 3 years ago, at the meeting of the Israeli Defense Forces annual banquet in New York, they had six former Israeli chiefs of staff at the Waldorf Astoria, and one and the then current chief of staff by video from Israel. And you had Mortimer Zuckerman, the owner of the Daily News, there as one of the honored guests. You had to pay a lot of money to come to these dinners. I think it's $1,500 a ticket, or $15,000, I'm not sure. For them, it doesn't matter. Not a single word in any media in New York, any media in New York, other than the Jewish media. Now, this should be a story when six former Israeli chiefs of staff are in New York and they raised $23 million. And yet, when you talk to people who are involved with Palestinian work, they don't even know about this organization. They don't do what the Jewish community does. They don't monitor what the enemy is doing, and the Israeli Defense Forces and the Jewish establishment are objectively not only the enemy of the Palestinians, but at this point in time, the enemy of the American people, since they are trying to get the American people into another war on behalf of Israel. And I've said that before, that as I say, it doesn't matter what the majority of Jews think. They may be against the war and probably are against the war with Iran, but it doesn't matter. It's that core establishment that is dedicated first to Israel's interest and secondly to their own interest. What's good for America is not part of the equation.
Mm-hmm. I mean, to make an analogy, it didn't really matter what a majority of Germans thought. All that mattered is the ones in charge thought, and that's what happened there.
That's true, and the rest became good Germans, as most American Jews have been so brainwashed that, and so intimidated that they are afraid to say anything to anyone outside of their family or to other Jews because they don't want it to be used to create, quote-unquote, anti-Semitism. The difference, however, in Germany, if you criticize the Third Reich, you might end up behind bars or worse. But here you just might get ostracized in your own community.
Yeah, not comparable.
It's not comparable, no, not at all.
I think you can, though, if you're a professor or something, you can lose your job.
If you're not tenured, you could. But I'll tell you, take the case of Professor Joseph Mossad. A Palestinian friend of mine in New York calls him Joseph Mossad. Joseph Mossad was targeted by something called the David Project at Columbia University and accused of being anti-Semitic and harassing Jewish students. He was a victim. They made a movie about him, attacking him. Lo and behold, he's Palestinian too. Lo and behold, when Mearsheimer and Walt published their article in the London Review of Books, which predated their book, the very first person to write an attack on Mearsheimer and Walt on the book on the Israel lobby was none other than Professor Joseph Mossad in Counterpunch. Mm-hmm. And then this other Lebanese professor, Assad Abu Halil, another one who doesn't believe the lobby is the problem, published it in his blog. And I read this and I felt, this is outrageous. Here is the Israel lobby, which controls the U.S. Congress, determines U.S. policy or the Palestinians, and a Palestinian professor in the same school that Edward Said taught in has the nerve to be the first one to defend the Israel lobby from attack. Let me tell you, for those people who aren't in this country, that I have been involved in the Palestine Solidarity Movement since 1971, when I came back from 4 months in the Middle East in Palestinian refugee camps. And I was a founding member of the November 29th Committee on Palestine, Palestine Solidarity Committee, which I left to start the Middle East Labor Committee because the Palestine Solidarity Committee would not criticize the Israeli Labor Federation, Histadrut, because it was a labor federation, nor would they criticize the AFL-CIO for its support for Israel. But the movement has been, in two words, an utter failure. It has had no measurable impact, positive impact, on anything either in occupied Palestine or in the United States. While there are more people are active around Palestine, Israel today, the Israel lobby is much more powerful than ever. And even they've had, in the last few years, they've had conferences in Washington. I don't know if we talked about this last time. Move Over AIPAC, Occupy AIPAC, and so on, which these conferences were designed to give the impression that there's a movement criticism of AIPAC. In fact, these were part of a cover-up, in my estimation. In the first year, we were able to get a panel. Grant Smith, Allison Ware of If Americans Knew, Janet McMahon of Washington Report, and myself. We had a panel, a workshop on AIPAC. The room was packed. People were standing around. I'm standing, but all the seats were taken. It was a good-sized room. And they finally had to make us break it up because we had gone on too long and people were really interested. That was the only panel in this whole event that dealt with AIPAC. Then, in the second year, they didn't give us a panel, but they left some space in the early evening so we could have a panel. And we added Hatem Bazian, one of the few Palestinian professors in this country who will actually talk about the lobby and has for years. And so we filled that space, and that was fortunately about 125 people from the event that Code Pink and the Institute for Policy Studies put on stayed to listen. And this year, there was no room for us to get in at all. And they had a panel on AIPAC, in which somebody from Gaza, a woman from Gaza, spoke. And what would she know about AIPAC? And someone, an Iranian, spoke, and he knows something about Iran and the lobby, but not the history of the lobby. And so what we see is an operation within the movement designed to cover up for AIPAC, but pretending to be otherwise. And behind all this is her gray eminence itself, Phyllis Bennis, who is the female Chomsky. She's always on Democracy Now, and she's very glib. She analyzes the Palestinian-Israeli situation very well. But when it comes to the lobby, she takes a Chomsky position.
They like to focus on the end of, like, they'll talk about the occupation, but not the roots of it or how it's financed or why the U.S. is so beholden to give them $3 billion every year. And I think it would do us a lot of good if we could put the focus more on aid to Israel. And it doesn't have to be as a Palestinian solidarity movement. Just as Americans, we don't want to give $3 billion away to a state that's engaged in murdering children and demolishing houses. You know, it doesn't matter who it's being done to. It's being done to people. Instead of doing it as a such and such, I think Americans, because I don't, if you can't get them with the moral portion of it, maybe that the economic incentives of foreign aid in the time period where the economy is so bad, maybe that will motivate them to say, hey, I don't want to give $3 billion to anybody. And if you cut off the finances, then they have a reason to change their behavior, but you can complain till the cows come home about the occupation, and the Israelis have no incentive to change what they're doing because there's no consequence for it. They openly do it. They continue to get money. So why would they change their behavior? They're getting land. they are killing off, wiping a country off the map, which is what they ideologically want to do. It's not apartheid. They're not trying to exploit them and use them for labor. They want them dead. They want them gone, and they want a Jewish state, like ethnically pure state, with a Jewish majority and whatever that means to them. And so we've got to cut off the money, and I think that would be a much better angle, and to get it outside of just BDSM or whatever, just get out of that and talk about cutting foreign aid in general to all groups. And I think that would be a better focus.
Well, actually, I've been pushing for cutting aid for years. But somehow within the movement, they prefer to say end the occupation, a phrase which not only is inaccurate because it's an ethnic cleansing, not an occupation. Mm-hmm. U.S. and Iraq was an occupation. This is ethnic cleansing. But I couldn't get people to go behind that. I mean, in the 80s, when Nicaraguan Contras were supposed to get $15 million from Congress, they had a national telephone campaign to members of Congress to stop that $15 million, and they succeeded. Some of the very same people who were involved with that were also involved in Palestine Solidarity, some of the same organizations, but somehow they didn't bring up the question of money.
And we now, give that much money away every day to Israel. $15 million is at least $10 million a day.
At that time, it was at least $15 million a day that we knew about it. But the $3.1 billion, which is now $3.5 billion, is only what we know. There's other monies that are hidden within budgets that we don't know. And I know, I agree with you, if the American people knew this was happening, and the fact that they were never informed about it because the newspapers do not report it, they would be angry. They would be angry. And
I think so. They'd be mad at the press and the politicians once this got out. I mean, this is a meta issue because it makes all the rest of it fall apart. They lose their money. They lose their ability to ethically cleanse. The Americans get mad not only at the politicians for giving away their money, but also the press for never covering the fact that there is ethnic cleansing going on and that we're paying for it.
One other thing is they get their money in a different way than other countries. They get their money within 1 month of the budget being passed in cash. So that means even though that $3.1 billion was intended to be spent with Lockheed Martin and Raytheon, I'm not sure, they get cash, and then they deposit that money in a bank and buy U.S. Treasury notes to collect what interest they can get. Then the U.S. has to borrow money in order to give Israel that cash.
We're borrowing money at interest so that they can take the cash and get interest from us.
And this has been going on. And this is actually the Congressional Research Report over the years has discussed this. I mean, this is not a secret, except only a handful of people talk about it. And the people who say they support Palestine either are lazy or hypocrites, but they never investigate this at all. This is never a subject of the meetings. The various meetings take place around the country, all these conferences in which they're talking about all kinds of things, except what can be done here to stop Israel. And this because the Palestinians can only do so much. Right now, they're in the worst shape they've been in since 1948. They have collaborators negotiating with Israel. it's like Alice in Wonderland.
Well, that was the thing with a boss after Arafat was poisoned, which now has come out that he was. They replaced him with a useless puppet.
Well, the thing, Arafat had become a puppet as well, but he didn't go as far. I guess he had done as much as he could for them. I mean, the Oslo situation is, as Edward Said first said, was another second Nakba. Because here is a situation in which Arafat sent Abbas to negotiate in Oslo, but he did not send any Palestinian lawyer, Roger Sharani, Roger Shahada. No Palestinian lawyer went to Oslo. And after the real agreement was signed, Palestinians did not have a copy of it in Arabic, and the Israelis threatened to publish it in Arabic if Arafat didn't do certain things. I was sitting with Nawal al-Sadawi, an Egyptian feminist writer, an incredible woman, at a meeting in the Arab bookstore in San Francisco, and this was signed, and she simply said, Arafat's agreed to be Israel's sheriff. And it's interesting, shortly thereafter, Shlomo Gazi, the former head of Israeli intelligence, came to San Francisco, and he went to speak at a synagogue in liberal San Francisco. And he explained how Oslo is good for Israel. And some madman with a German accent, Jewish madman with a little button with a picture must of his son on it, came running down the aisle in German accent, said, it's Munich, Munich, another Munich. And believing that, intending to say that Oslo was a sellout by Israel, like the Germans, like the British sold out Czechoslovakia in 38. And Shlomo Gazit, who negotiated Oslo, said, my friend, as much as I do not like to make the comparisons, if it's Munich, we're the Germans and the Palestinians are the Czechs. And I recorded that and I published it in the Middle East Labor Bulletin. But that is the essence of what it was. It was a surrender by a Palestinian quisling, in this case Arafat, surrendering Palestinian land to Israel and delegitimizing Palestinian resistance to the occupation. It was a disaster which the Palestinians have not recovered from.
I still think it's gotten worse, since his death. I mean, one puppet. Oh,
it's gotten worse.
Yeah.
It's gotten worse. It's gotten worse because Abbas, the only reason Abbas is alive is to do what he's doing. The only reason Arafat stayed alive as long as he was alive was to do what Israel needed him to do, to sign. He was the only one who could actually sign away Palestinian rights. And now Abbas has no support among the Palestinians. He doesn't need to. He's like an international thing. And Erekat, is another one. It's pathetic. The whole thing, as many Palestinians say, the Palestinian Authority should dissolve. It's a terrible, terrible time to be a Palestinian because there's no hope on the horizon. Here now they're talking about making Marwan Barghouti a vice president. Well, Marwan Barghouti has been in prison for quite a few years now, and the Palestinian Authority has done absolutely nothing to raise an international campaign to free him, nor has a solidarity movement in this country. We had Free Mandela. The Israelis ran around the world trying to free this soldier, Gilad Shalit, but not a word for Barghouti. And then some Palestinian PLO person said, well, if we make Barghouti a vice president, that will help get him released. That's just nonsense and opportunism, but I hope if that Barghouti will say no.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask Obama real quick, because he's bent over backwards for the Israelis, and they still tend to hate him. Why such hate towards Barack Obama? I mean, he's been giving them money, giving them aid, ignoring all their slaughter, and yet they hate him anyway.
The Israelis are racist. I have never been in a place that is so racist as Israel, and I was there. When I went there at first in 1983, I was just astounded. The racism is not hidden. It's unapologetic. And many of the American Jews who go to Israel are racist, and they go to Israel, and I found out instead of having to hide their racism, they can be openly racist there. And within Jewish religion, going back to Maimonides, who is a racist, they're wonderful Maimonides. Israel Shahak pointed out in the Talmud where he talks about the Cush people. The Cush people were black people, and just, they consider them like subhuman. And this is actually how the European, the Ashkenazi Israelis considered Middle Easterners and people of dark skin. And one of the problems, even Israelis who supported the Palestinians to some extent, had is they looked at Arab Jews from the Middle East, the Mizrahim, as being inferior. And that's how Menachem Begin and the Likud used the racism of the European Jews toward the Arab Jews to get them into power. A lot of people don't know that. The Italian fascists used that as well in Italy, where the Communist Party paid no attention to the poor non-union workers in Calabria in the south of Italy. And so the right wing in Italy used those workers against the Communist Party. The Communist Party snubbed them. This happened in Israel. And so one of the first things that the Israeli Ben-Gurion did when they brought in the Middle Eastern Jews after Israel had become a state was to de-Levantize them. He wanted to break their ties with the Middle East. And so they provided protection for all the European settlements, but no protection for the Mizrahi and the Middle Eastern Jewish settlements. So the Palestinian Fedayeen would attack the Middle Eastern Jewish settlements. And an Israeli Middle Eastern friend of mine, who was a founder of something called the Black Panthers back in the 80s, after the U.S. Black Panthers, realized he was working one day on building defenses in an Ashkenazi settlement and realized that where he lived, they had no protection. And the Palestinians, of course, if you're attacking Israel, they saw the Israelis as being one, they would go at the weakest point. And so the Israelis cleverly left the Middle Eastern Jewish settlement towns undefended in order to alienate the Arab Jews from their Palestinian cousins, because obviously they're ethnically, in every way, shape, or form, other than religion, the Arab Jews and the Palestinian Jews, I mean, the Arab Jews and the Palestinian Arabs have much more in common than the than the Arab Jews had with the Europeans. No question about it.
So they just but have this is something Obama's a secret Muslim and he's half black, so we hate him sort of thing.
Like, well, they think he's a secret Muslim. Barack Hussein Obama, they love to use his middle name. And that they're racist. There's a term which is the equivalent of nigger in the Jewish culture called Schwarze. And this was something that's been used in this country when American Jews who have maids, they refer to them as their Schwarzes. You know, it's a demeaning term. And the Israelis as a country, as a people, not everyone, but the majority of them, are overwhelmingly racist. They've shown that simply by living there, although a number have left for various reasons.
Especially if you're a settler. You pretty much...
If you're a settler.
Yeah. Did you see Max Blumenthal's... I forgot the other one. He and another guy did a short film about the African migrants... And you can just see crowds of racist people. They won't give them work.
Oh, I saw that. The racism against African migrants, the films that you see, obscenity. I mean, the problem is if African Americans in the United States, whose leadership, I call it an invisible plantation. That for years, the African-American leadership in this country, the religious leadership, is dependent on Jewish money. So it's become like an invisible plantation. And if you criticize Israel, like you're outside of it. And otherwise, you bend your knee and apologize like Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, and they accept you back in the fold. But not completely. You're always on like probation. And now, of course... the target is Latino Americans, Mexican Americans particularly, the fastest growing sector of the population is Mexican American. And so the American Jewish Committee, their foreign policy group, and the ADL have been targeting the leadership of the Mexican American community for a long time. They haven't got the base, but they have the leadership in their pocket, just like The Black Caucus, which properly called the House Negro Caucus in Congress, it's been stripped of all those in Congress, black politicians, who would had the temerity to criticize Israel. You have the same thing with Latino politicians. They need money. They don't get it from their own community. And you have wealthy Jewish donors who are ready to turn it over to them in order to buy their votes. And so these members of Congress rationalize getting this money and supporting Israel because they think they could help their own communities. It's obscene. It's got to stop.
I think the phenomenon of ethnic groups voting in blocks is weird in and of itself. I don't know how everyone could say, well, I'm such and such, so we're all going to vote this way. I mean, I don't know how that many people could all have the same interests in common. I think that's a problem, a separate problem, is for people to have like race identity politics or ethnic identity politics where they consider themselves a category instead of a person and they just vote the way the group tells them to. That's just stupid.
I don't, with the black community, they have voted against black politicians who they don't think helps them. But when someone like Obama came along, and he was picked like from central casting to play the role that he played, I understood. I mean, he's a likable guy. This is why. I mean, he looks likable. You hear him talk, he's likable. This is a selling point, and why he was picked by whoever picked him to be the candidate. He was a person who could bail out Wall Street and get away with it. He's a person who could use drones and kill people all over the world and get away with it. He was a human face on U.S. imperialism. Get away with it.
They still love him in Europe, too. They think he's the best thing ever. And
well, I think now, I don't think today, if he went to Germany, he would be able to go out in public without being attacked for the spying that he's endorsed.
Right.
I think that Edward Snowden has done an amazing job in exposing the United States for what it is. And hopefully, well, I don't know if anything to come from it here, but at least around the world, they know that the United States cannot be trusted. I mean, those who believe that it could be trusted. And then, of course, the irony is behind the United States, when it comes to Middle East policy, is you know who. And the whole question here, I mean, this is the push for sanctions, for making a deal with Iran is historic. Now, we've seen that the French, acting for their own interest and pushed by...
They're getting Saudi weapon sales now, which originally came from the U.S.
Yeah, they may be. I mean, the Saudis have kept the U.S. weapons manufacturers in business with their purchases. They have more weapons than they can use. They don't even have an army that sufficient to use them. Now I've read that they're gonna develop an Islamic army that they can send various places, like the French Foreign Legion. But also, there was a story that a French Jewish member of parliament prevailed upon the French foreign minister, saying that if Israel is going to attack Iran if we make a deal with Iran. And that was what prompted the French to not go along with the interim deal with Iran. So it's an interesting time with U.S.-Israel relations. But I could predict that AIPAC and the Jewish establishment, but AIPAC in particular, will be pushing for new sanctions against Iran in the coming weeks. And this will be an interesting time for people to watch the power struggle here, where where the White House is virtually isolated, and you have the Jewish establishment simply saying, it's us against the world.
Yeah, and in most of the world, and most of the public of the world, not just the leadership, but most people in the world wanted peace with Iran. Everybody wanted negotiations except for the Israelis and the Saudis, it seemed like. And they were willing to kick and scream and bribe and do whatever they had to do to dismantle the peace process. I just wish we had more Bobby Kennedy types in the Justice Department or something, but those days seem to be long gone.
Those days are long gone. JFK, I found an article. Here's JFK. We hear about all the UN resolutions against Israel that the U.S. censured or vetoed, but we never hear about the ones that weren't vetoed, like under JFK. That's another story, but
that's JFK, a whole other show, but let's talk about another it sometime. Show. Yeah, that's another, because we've gone over an hour already, but
right,
that is
I
an
see
interesting
that.
Thing, and we'll talk about the Kennedys next time. I'd love to talk about that with you, actually. Excellent. Well, thank you for your time once again, and I'll have you on. I like to have you on as much as possible, really. This is the 50th anniversary of John Kennedy's death, so let's try and do it before the end of the month, maybe.
Okay, my pleasure.
Thanks.
Take care.